This is Michael Scharf. The date is November 18th, 2010. I'm sitting with Dr. Alok Shukla, who's the Deputy Election Commissioner at the Election Commission of India. Sir, thank you very much for agreeing to this meeting today. If I could just ask perhaps for our listeners, if you could introduce yourself and tell us how you first became involved in the administration of Indian elections.
Well, you already said, my name is Alok Shukla. I am Deputy Election Commissioner here in the Election Commission of India. And I am part of the civil service of India. So in the course of a routine posting, I have been posted here in the Secretariat of the Election Commission.
And how long have you been in your current role as Deputy Commissioner?
A little less than 2 years.
And so before that, you were also here with the Election
Commission? Before that, also, I was involved with the elections, but in one of the states. I was in the state of Chhattisgarh, where I was Chief Electoral Officer for the state of Chhattisgarh for approximately 2.5 years.
Can I ask, if somebody were to say, what does violence during elections in India look like? How would you categorize it?
See, if you look at, there are different types of violence which happens. Of course, nowadays, with the current management techniques which Election Commission of India follows, violence is pretty much, it's very less, if I may say so. But there are two different kinds of things which happen. One is the political violence, which is more or less controlled. I mean, you hardly ever come across nowadays cases of political violence and of the kind which are basically related to electoral politics. But there is also sometimes you'll find violence which is not directly related with elections, but you are going for elections in an area which has, other than that, you have a different type of violence. For example, as you know that in India we have certain areas which are affected with left-wing terrorism. So, I mean, if you have left-wing terrorism in that particular area, there is violence related to left-wing terrorism. But it is hardly electoral violence. It's whether there are elections there or there are no elections there, there is that violence there. It's not really directly related to elections. So that is one type of violence. The other type of violence would be which is directly related to elections. I mean, if there is violence between contesting candidates, or if there is violence among the electorate as a result of the elections being there. That kind of a violence is pretty much controlled these days.
And why is that? What has been done to sort of help control
there are,
that violence?
There are many things which have been done. First of all, Election Commission uses a lot of police force also. Police force of the state where the election is held. And lots of central police forces are also at the command of the Election Commission of India, which is being used primarily for the purpose of show of force, rather than the actual use of force. Which means if the gundas, if the bad elements, so to say, know that there is enough police force available, and that if they try something, then they are not going to be spared, then they would rather desist from doing that kind of a thing. That's one part of it. That's one way of doing it. The second is, again, our experience has been that if people know that they are going, that somebody is going to find out about what they have done and that they are likely to be punished for it, then they will think twice before doing it. They would rather not do it. They would do it more often if they feel that nobody is going to catch them. So therefore, we also use lots of other measures, measures other than police force. For example, we make a lot of use of video recordings. These days, in Indian elections, Election Commission of India uses video recording as a very interesting weapon against violence. And the simple thing that you do is that you hire a large number of people with a video camera who just keep going round in the area where electioneering takes place. And if any untoward thing is likely to happen, they will just stay there and shoot, take pictures. You know, instead of shooting with a gun, you shoot with a camera. That becomes evidence which can be used against these people to punish them. And therefore, we find that many of these people, if they see that there's a video camera around, or even an ordinary still camera around,
sure.
They would rather not indulge into activities which they would otherwise do.
So what
now, one very interesting, instruction which the Election Commission issued a few years back was that if we have a candidate, any candidate anywhere, with criminal antecedents, he will be followed with a video camera 24 hours a day. There's a person carrying a video camera following that person continuously 24 hours a day. 24 hours means from the time he comes out of his residence to till the time he goes back into his residence. Understand? Can you just stop it for a moment? So as I was telling you, the instructions of the commission are that if there is a candidate with criminal background, criminal antecedents, this candidate has to be followed continuously with a video camera. And we found that this is very effective. Since the time that we started doing this, the level of violence has really, really come down. Because they see that it's being recorded as an evidence which can be used against them. So this is one. Now, the second thing that the commission has also started doing is the use of, I'm sure you would know that commission uses lots of election observers, and election observers in India are different from election observers elsewhere, because election observers in India are not international observers, they are observers appointed by the Election Commission of India under law. And these are normally very senior civil servants. They go and observe elections in states which are not their home states, and also not in the states where they are otherwise working. So if somebody is working in, please come.
We were starting to talk before about the process by which this idea of vulnerability mapping came about. The way I understand it, the 2007 UP elections was the first time that vulnerability mapping was implemented as a strategic exercise. I'm curious where the idea for this exercise came from.
See, I think where we left out was different methods used by the commission for preventing violence, as it were. And I was explaining to you that the use of a video camera or use of an ordinary still camera has really contributed a lot to this. The second thing that, I'll just continue with that and then come to the vulnerability mapping part. The second interesting thing which has happened in the past 1 year is the use of webcasting. So what we are doing is more and more at the polling station we are putting webcams, ordinary webcams connected on the internet, so that on the poll day, everything which happens at the polling station is not only recorded, but in real time, it is put on the internet for the world to see. And again, we found that it has brought down disorderly behavior, violence, everything, all of these kinds of things to a very large extent. Because people know that whatever is happening there is not only being recorded, but is being seen by the world. That, again, has been very, very helpful. The third thing, which very few people really realize, is the great power which the Election Commission of India has of ordering a repoll. And the Election Commission has made it very clear to all concerned that if we get any information that there was violence or there was anything which happened which has vitiated the poll, then the commission will not tolerate it and order a re-poll to be taken. And because, you know, what happens is that on the normal poll day, you have polling in thousands of polling stations.
Mm.
But on the re-poll, there will be very, very few polling stations where polling is happening. So therefore, all your efforts are concentrated on those few polling stations where you have re-poll, and then you can ensure that anything which vitiates the polling process doesn't happen.
When was re-polling first started?
Re-polling has been there for all the time, but the commission has increasingly used re-polling as an instrument of preventing things which can lead to vitiation of poll. So the candidates and all other stakeholders realize that if they try to do something through violent means or through a process or something which vitiates the polling process, they're not going to succeed in it because the commission will order a re-poll. So it doesn't help them. You know, you might,
sure,
for example, think that, okay, if there are 1,000 people, I'll beat 5 of them, and then
sure,
I'll tell everybody that, you know, if you don't do this, then I'm going to beat you. But if you realize that in spite of all of that, the votes polled on that day are not going to be counted at all, because the commission will then take a re-poll, then there is no point in beating up people also.
Whose decision is it to ask for or order a re-poll?
Re-poll is ordered by the Election Commission in Delhi, in every single instance. However, the request can be made by anybody. The request can be made by candidates, the request can be made by political parties, and also the election officials who are posted in the field, in the district. Then the commission, as I explained to you, sends its observers. We have nowadays micro-observers who are responsible for either one single polling station or a group of 3 or 4 polling stations.
Mm.
These are also senior officers who are sent by the commission to observe the polling process. And if they feel that something wrong has happened, they can also recommend a re-poll to the Election Commission. Then the commission watches video footage, the commission watches the webcast, the commission watches still photographs, commission watches media reports, and using all of this, if the commission anywhere feels that a re-poll is necessary, it doesn't hesitate in ordering a re-poll.
And by commission, we mean the chief election commissioner and yourself and the other deputy?
No. By commission, we mean the commission. See, under the Constitution...
Who is the commission?
Okay. Under the Constitution of India, the election commission is the chief election commissioner and election commissioners. Election commissioners and chief election commissioner are appointed by the President of India. As of now, there is one chief election commissioner and 2 other election commissioners. But the number of 2 other election commissioners is not constant. It can vary. But as of now, there is one chief election commissioner and 2 election commissioners. We are not the commission. We are the secretariat of the commission to help the commission, to assist the commission. So there is Mr. Qureshi, who is the chief election commissioner. There is Mr. Sampath, who is the election commissioner. And there is Mr. Brahma, who is also the election commissioner.
Mm.
The 3 of them sit like a bench and decide.
Mm-hmm.
We help them. So we basically provide information, prepare files and put up to them for decision. But the decision is taken by the commission.
Understood.
We are like the registry of a court.
Right.
So we are the registry and they are the court. Okay, now let me come to the vulnerable.
Well, let me actually keep you on this subject, because I think
okay,
it's really fascinating. We'll go back to that. You mentioned this webcasting, and there's a big push today to introduce technology in election processes worldwide. So I think somebody would find this really interesting. Where was the first example where we saw this webcasting?
Webcasting actually started very recently. It started from Arunachal Pradesh.
Okay.
And, you know, it came about very interestingly because, you know, Arunachal Pradesh is in the far eastern part of India, very, very remote. And there are polling stations in Arunachal Pradesh where polling parties have to walk sometimes 50, 60, 70 kilometers to reach the polling station because there is no good road there to sort of go there. So you can't take a vehicle and go there. You have to walk, go there on foot. Now there was a very young, dynamic officer, a district collector, posted in a district. The district is Tirap, which is on Burma border. It borders Burma. There he was posted, and we had three polling stations, which are very, very far away. And it was not possible for anybody to reach the polling station to see what is happening there on the poll day. So the polling party goes there 3-4 days in advance and then stays there, takes the poll, and then comes back on foot. So we were trying to find different ways of finding out what is happening at the polling station on the poll day itself in real time. And this young, bright officer came up with this very interesting, he's just about what, five years into service, and most of the time you'll find that technology solutions are given by the young people, because you know young people are more technology savvy. So he came up with this solution. He said, you know, why don't we simply put a small webcam there with an internet connection, and then we can see what is happening there in real time. So the commission said, yes, try it out. And he tried it out with great amount of success, and sitting here in this building, all of us and the commission saw in real time what is happening at the polling stations. So they were then fascinated by this. And then from then on, the commission has been using this more and more. In the recently held Bihar elections, webcasting was used in more than 600 polling stations.
And the first, this example that you cited, what year was this?
It was 2009, last year.
Do you have any sense of the number of, or the percentage of polling stations that use webcasting?
As of now, it's very limited. As of now, it's very limited because, for example, I said Bihar used about 600, and the total number of polling stations in Bihar would be about 30,000.
But
it's increasing. So from three polling stations, it's come to 600 polling stations in another election.
Sure.
So therefore, you know, over a period of time, it's increased.
Now, the issue of taking video.
But also, please remember, we also don't insist on a webcast everywhere. For example, you know, if there's a polling station across the road on this in this building, you don't really need webcasting. You can actually go and see what's happening there. So webcasting is more useful primarily in locations which are difficult to reach.
Does the vulnerability mapping, as it is now, the criterion that you have, does that help you to identify the polling stations
where
webcasting
Vulnerability mapping is a totally different concept. I'll come to that.
Please.
But this is the criteria for webcasting primarily is the connectivity. Connectivity, not the internet connectivity, but you know the whether you can reach there.
Okay.
If you can't reach there physically, then you can at least reach there through a webcast.
Okay.
Now, vulnerability mapping, let me explain that. See, earlier, the commission used to take lots of measures to prevent intimidation on the poll day. And we used to talk in terms of booth capturing, but when we said booth capturing, most of the time what we meant was that somebody actually physically goes to a polling booth, captures it, and casts all the votes or most of the votes in favor of a particular candidate. That certainly is a thing of the past now. It cannot happen because so many people are watching that if somebody even tries this, the commission, if nothing else, we'll order a repoll, certainly. But in the UP elections, which you mentioned, a very interesting thing actually came to be seen. And the commission realized that this is something which is similar to silent booth capturing. Now, you know that on the poll day, at the time of the poll, what is happening is that you have the electoral roll, the roll on the basis of which the voters will come and cast their vote. And this roll, in most cases, will have about 1,000, 1,500, or 2,000 voters in one polling station. So it's like a small booklet of names, and other details are printed there. And as I said, the commission appoints senior civil servants as election observers who are supposed to be there on the poll day, and they keep going around and keep a watch on what is happening. So one observer was extremely vigilant, and what he found was, and I'm, I'm telling this more in the form of a story because, you know, then not only it will be interesting, but it will actually tell you that. So this observer, what he found was that in more than one polling stations, he found that while people from the first few pages were coming and voting and people from the last few pages were coming and voting, but there were large number of people, you know, the whole pages in the middle were totally unrepresented in the sense that nobody comes and votes. So, you know, he suddenly questioned that why is it so that people, you know, while some people are voting, there's a large population which is not coming to vote at all. Because, you know, what happens is in our case, when we make the electoral roll is arranged in such a manner that people living in one area are together on the page.
Okay.
So when you are saying that people from certain pages are not coming to vote, it actually means that people from certain localities
are not coming
and voting. So it struck the observer that why is it that people from certain habitations, certain localities are not coming to vote at all? Now, mind you, that's why, I mean, this is not in the nature of prevention of electoral violence, more in the nature of preventing intimidation later on.
Please.
This whole vulnerability mapping. There was no violence anywhere to be seen. The polling was going on extremely peacefully. There was no violence. Absolutely, you know, anybody who goes from outside would have found it to be absolutely normal. Even the poll percentage was not very low. You know, if in general you find that there is about 60% polling, even in this polling station it was 60% polling. But what struck him really is that it is people from certain localities who are not coming to vote. So then he decided on his own to go to that area and find out. So he went there and he asked those people, why are you not voting? And then these people told him that, you know, that we belong to the vulnerable communities. And therefore we've been told that if you go and vote, then you will suffer the consequences, whatever they might be, by some of the bad elements in that area. So at that point of time, what he did was very simple. He said, okay, I'll get some police force and I'll escort you to the polling station so that you don't feel intimidated. And therefore, he escorted these people to the polling station so that they were able to come and vote. Now, the observer then made his report to the election commission. So when the election commission saw that this has actually happened, the commission thought that this phenomena may actually be much more widespread than a few polling stations. From this, the concept of vulnerability mapping evolved. So the commission then gave instructions that in all future elections, much before the date of the election, you know, at least 15, 20 days, 1 month in advance, the election officers will do a vulnerability mapping of the polling station area, which means they will identify those localities where vulnerable communities live. Having identified them, our officers will go into that area, not on the poll day, before the poll day, and build their confidence that we know we have identified you as vulnerable people and we are going to be helping you so that nobody is able to do anything wrong to you. And then the identification goes further. What we do is we identify localities and communities which are vulnerable, we also identify their leaders. So if there is a vulnerable community, who is the person who is their leader? These days, as you know, that penetration of cell phones, mobile is very, very high, even in India. So we try and take the cell phone number of this person and we give our cell phone number to them, saying that, you know, if there is anything, you can call on this particular number directly so that we can help you. And we are taking your number so that on the poll day, we can call you and find out whether you are able to come and vote or not, whether you need any help from
us.
Then the second step is we also try and identify people who have made them vulnerable. So you know, who are the persons who are likely to intimidate them? Generally, you will find that these are muscle men or people with money bags in and around that area. Those people are identified, and then we take preventive action under the law against those people. For example, in under the Criminal Procedure Code in India, there is a provision of taking bond for good behavior. You can take a bond with or without surety. So you take a bond, you take some surety from some other respectable people in the community and say, we have identified this person. This person is likely to intimidate vulnerable communities. You give a bond of whatever, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000, that you are surety, you stand surety for the good behavior of this person. Okay, so we do that. In rare cases where we find that this person is not likely to behave properly in spite of this, there is the provision of preventive arrest. If they have arms licenses, etc., they are temporarily suspended, their arms are deposited in the police thana, and then we keep a watch on them, and if these are really, really big muscle men, we also put a video camera on them so that we track their movement. What is it that they are doing? Now, on the poll day, on the poll day, instructions are given to all the officers to specially see that people from the vulnerable localities are actually coming and voting. And if we find that people are not voting, then somebody has to visit that area and, if necessary, escort them to the polling station. Mm-hmm. That's the concept.
That's the concept of vulnerability. It's a fascinating concept and a way to build on previous efforts that were made. I just wonder, you know, with the story of this observer in UP, seeing that a whole chunk of the population from particular geographic areas were not coming to vote, why this issue hadn't been brought up earlier? If observers were to be checking the lists as an observer, why is this the first time? Or is this or is it perhaps complaints have been registered, but there's somebody at the Election Commission now, a reformer, if you will, who says now's the time to honor these complaints. Let's get the ball rolling. Here's an idea. Let's try it. Because I've got to believe that for decades and decades, similar complaints were being aired because this practice was in place of denying entire areas and intimidating entire regions. So I think the question is just why is
it? It's actually, you know, I wasn't here at the time. As I explained to you, I am here only for about 2 years. So I wouldn't know exactly what transpired here on that particular day. But what I certainly know is that our present Chief Election Commissioner, Mr. Qureshi, was extremely keen on vulnerability mapping, and it is primarily his efforts which, you know, he's been instrumental in really the evolution of the whole concept.
Mm-hmm. But it was Mr. Gopalswamy Mr. Balakrishnan,
yeah,
who was the Chief Commissioner.
Mr. Balakrishnan was like one of us. He was the Deputy Election Commissioner.
Okay. But at the time, was it Mr. Gopalswamy who would have been
Mr. Gopalswamy was the
Chief
Election Commissioner.
Okay.
And the other two commissioners at that time were Mr. Naveen Chawla and Mr. Qureshi. Bala was the Deputy Election Commissioner, like me, like some of us. You know, he was part of the Secretariat of the Commission. So we are the bureaucracy of the Commission.
Sure. So it was a personality that decided to take action.
Well, I mean, partly that, and I think maybe partly that, you know, the time was right for it, probably. Also partly because, you know, the more obvious methods of booth capturing had already been taken care of by that time. Mm. So the commission therefore had the opportunity of taking care of the less obvious ones. Mm.
But I would imagine that a decision like vulnerability mapping is going to make a lot of the political parties very mad.
As a matter of fact, no. The political parties have actually been very supportive of this idea. Because, see, no political party can say that you should not protect the vulnerable communities? Political parties are supposed to be standing for vulnerable communities, not against them.
I can see how the political parties that were underrepresented, the opposition, if you will, that was being quieted, silenced by the strongmen, would agree that this was a good thing. But the ruling parties, for instance, in the particular areas where we're discussing this in the States, I mean, they had an incentive, I mean, to want to not see this come to fruition. They had their strongmen and their musclemen out there on the streets. Now you're putting in all these steps. You're rounding up their political party operatives.
I
away their cash and their liquor. I mean, you're making all of these constraints for them to rig the voting.
See, we will have to make a difference between the political parties and there are certain elements within the political parties. So no political party would stand, if they believe in democracy, no political party would actually stand for winning elections by distribution of liquor or by muscle or, no political party, the party would stand for that. There obviously would some elements within the party who would try to do this. So as a matter of fact, the good thing would be that by the measures which the Election Commission is taking, these elements would get marginalized. And the real good people within political parties would then assume center stage.
But I think a skeptic who comes to this from, who's not very familiar with Indian elections, but only knows sort of the buzzword of Indian elections, which is this widespread corruption that does take place, would be very skeptical of this idea. But I think this just comes back to the question of trying to understand, what sort of pressures there may have been on the Election Commission at the time to put this thing in place.
See, having worked in the Election Commission for almost 2 years now, what I can definitely say is that the Election Commission is a very, very fiercely independent body. So it doesn't, pressures don't work on Election Commission at all. Mm-hmm. We are, the once a person has been made Election Commissioner of India, he's beyond these kinds of pressures. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying it from experience, because in the last 2 years I've seen this kind of a thing happening. Mm-hmm. It might have happened that people who were before this, this idea might not have come to them, might not have struck them. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it was because of any sort of pressures that they were not able to do it, or the present commission did it because it was under pressure. No, okay. I don't agree with that.
Something that came out of this is if you look on the Election Commission's website, if people visit, they can see the guidelines for the vulnerability mapping. It explicitly spells out what the chief electoral officer in the state and his deputies are supposed to do. Do you have any idea who actually drafted those recommendations? Where would those recommendations have come from?
No, that I think. Bala at that time was the Deputy Election Commissioner,
okay.
And he was in charge of, we have something called a planning division within the Election Commission of India. So Bala looked after the planning commission, the planning division. So the guidelines came out of the planning division. But the process that happens in the Election Commission of India is actually it's a very interesting process which we follow. It's very informal kind of an organization which we are. What happens generally is, it is quite different from most of the other ministries. In most of the other ministries, of course, we also have files, but what we normally do is, on the fourth floor, we have a small room which we call the commission room. It's like a board room. And every morning, for almost 4 hours, what happens is that the three commissioners, the CEC and the two other commissioners, they and senior officers, five or six of us. Every morning we have a meeting in the morning. The first few items on the agenda are points on which decision has to be taken. But then after that, almost every day for an hour or so, there is so much of brainstorming which happens there on how to improve things. And most of these drafts actually come out of that process of brainstorming. So, while It therefore it's become it, it's rather difficult to put a single name to this.
Sure.
So of course, yes, Bala was the Deputy Election Commissioner in charge at the time. It was his division which drafted it. But the whole process was through a very good process of consultation amongst all the officers who were there at this time.
Yeah, yeah. So Mr. Balakrishnan and his policy or his planning team may have come and sort of drafted some initial guidelines, and they would have perhaps sent them to the meeting, and then at this meeting they would have been discussed and more brainstorming
and a lot of changes would have taken
place. And they'd
place.
Go back to the planning, and then they'd be further refined, and so this is sort of a collaborative back and forth process at the end of the day. The issue of detentions of individuals is something I think that a lot of people wonder about, because there is quite a bit of room for the rounding up of supposed strongman Muslimmen to actually be, in some cases, a rounding up of political opposition. And given the fact that it's been well documented that the DMs and the DEOs have been in historically under political influence, people might question whether or not this is the best possible strategy to go about rounding up people when you have the Indian Human Rights Commission coming out with some figure that says something like 60% of all the arrests during elections are probably not necessary. What do you say to sort of the skeptics who ask, is this really doing its job and serving
its
purpose?
Let me put it this way. What is an election after all? An election is not about convincing the person who has won the election. An election is about convincing the person who has lost. It has to be credible to the person who has lost the election. And I think the big difference between India and many other countries is, and that's what shows that Indian democracy is mature and that the Election Commission of India is extremely independent and very effective, is the fact that in all the previous elections, losers have always accepted the result. They have, without any doubt, I know of instances where people have lost by one vote, still accepted. And you would never have seen anywhere in India that a party which loses power refuses to hand over power to the next party, the next person who wins. That speaks volumes. And in this office, we keep meeting persons from political parties across the country every day. As a matter of fact, the commission makes it a point to actually give more time to the opposition parties, rather than to the party in power. And by and large, what we have seen is that the Election Commission and its work is respected by politicians of all hues. They might have their differences here and there, but generally, by and large, Election Commission is respected, and people come with their grievances to the Election Commission and go back satisfied.
But this doesn't answer the question about the detentions of individuals.
I didn't say individuals. I'm saying the system, political parties. See, otherwise, since your question is so, you're saying whether these arrests are arbitrary and therefore more people from the opposition parties are getting arrested.
Maybe I should refer, because it was probably poorly asked. How does the Election Commission ensure that the individuals under its guidelines that are being arrested are being arrested for, that they're justified? What's the check?
Yeah, the check is that, as I explained to you, we have a whole system in place, and there are, first of all, under the Constitution, there is something called Article 324, under which Election Commission of India works, and as soon as election is announced in any state, the entire election machinery comes under the discipline and control of the Election Commission of India. So while in a non-election time, the district magistrates, the subdivisional magistrates, other officers working in the field while they may be subordinate to the politicians there and reporting to them, as soon as elections are announced, they become subordinate to the Election Commission of India and report to us and not to their bosses in the district. That's the first thing which happens. The second thing is that the Election Commission is extremely conscious and very vigilant about all of this, and therefore the Election Commission invariably organizes lots of monitoring meetings. So there are meetings at the state level, there are meetings in the district, there are meetings at the divisional level, there are video conferencing. Mm-hmm. And almost on a daily basis, the officers in the field have to report to us, either directly or through the other missionary that we have in place. At the state level, there is a representative of the Election Commission called the Chief Electoral Officer. He has his office at the state level, so some reports come through him. Then also, as I explained to you, we send senior civil servants of the level of Joint Secretary to Government of India to these districts. Generally, one person per constituency.
Sure.
These people go from outside and report directly to the Election Commission of India, not through a channel. Every observer of the Election Commission reports to the Election Commission of India directly. And his report is very seriously studied here in this office, and the Election Commission takes action on it. Third, the entire machinery comes under control of the Election Commission of India. We send observers, we have the Chief Electoral Officer. Then we meet political parties on a regular basis, proactively. It's not as if we are waiting for political parties to come and meet us. The Election Commission calls political parties. Whenever the Election Commission visits a state, the first part of the meeting is they call all political parties in alphabetical order and has detailed interaction with every political party, and their concerns are immediately addressed. So if the political parties have a feeling that some wrongdoing is taking place or some of their supporters have been wrongly arrested, etc., they will bring it to our notice and we immediately take action. Then the media. The Election Commission keeps a very, very strict watch on the media. So you have the print media, you have the TV channels, and we keep a watch on it, and anything which gets reported on the media is immediately taken into cognizance and the Election Commission acts on it. Now finally, the writ of the Election Commission runs because the Election Commission does not hesitate in taking action. So wherever we find that a district magistrate has been found lacking, he is transferred immediately, or why only district magistrate,
sure,
other officers, without a hitch, Election Commission transfers those officers out of office and brings in another officer for the duration of the election. And also, it is not just the transfer, departmental proceedings, action taken against him, punishment.
And again, when you keep mentioning this term, the commission, it's as you said before, I mean, all of these decisions are being, at the end of the day, taken by...
Oh, well, now, yes, in the sense that the Constitution has given the authority to the Election Commission, which means the three commissioners there.
Sure.
The Chief Election Commissioner, the two other commissioners. However, under the constitutional provisions, the Election Commission can delegate some of its authority to its officers. All right. So wherever the Election Commission feels that some of its authorities can be delegated, then authority can be delegated. The authority can be delegated to deputy election commissioners, it can be delegated to other officers down the line. But the important decisions are always made by the Election Commission themselves. As a matter of fact, during elections, you will find that they are in office for more than 18 hours a day, and they work day and night. Also, we have evolved a very interesting system, which I found only here in this particular organization. Earlier, when I worked in other organizations, I never found this. Because in the Election Commission, there's another very interesting thing. The decision is not by the Chief Election Commissioner. The decision is by the Commission, which means there are three of them, and the three of them have to sit together as a committee to decide. All right, and the decision is by majority of votes. So what happens? Now, there are instances, for example, let us say there is an election, let us say in Kerala, and I am Deputy Election Commissioner in charge of Kerala, and I am in Kerala, and I'm seeing something which is happening there on the ground. Okay, and let us say I need some decision of the Election Commission immediately. So what we do generally is, this is something also very interesting. Again, you can say use of technology or whatever. So all of them have their BlackBerries, So we will, if it's a small thing, we'll simply compose a small SMS, send the SMS to them, and they will make the order on SMS. If it's a longish kind of thing, then I'll compose, I means other officers like me, they will compose a detailed email, maybe 2 pages, 3 pages, 4 pages, and they get it on their BlackBerry. I've seen it happening in the middle of the night, at midnight sometimes, and within 5 minutes they will reply with a yes or a no. So when you're saying that, you know, all the decisions are taken by the commission, so then it will get delayed, and it doesn't get delayed in spite of that. And most of the time what will happen is that by the time I wake up in the morning, I will have their replies on my phone, and then I can issue the order then and there. Of course, when I come back, then I'll record it on a file and take their signatures on the file.
Okay.
But the decision is taken.
Interesting. I hesitate to take too much of your time. I know you've got quite a few, so maybe I can just sort of ask, bring this to a conclusion. I'm curious, who determines the number of security forces to go to a particular...
The commission.
The commission.
However, you must realize that it's a function of a very large consultative process.
Sure.
Now, for example, if the election commission says, for example, that I need an army, a whole army there, then obviously, you know, you can't really ask for something which is impossible. So what the election commission does is the process which is followed. What is the process? Before an election, and of course, it's a small, if the small